North Tulsa, Oklahoma, the winter of 2007. The streets here were already hard. People knew that. They knew which corners to avoid after dark, which houses to keep their distance from, which names made conversations go quiet. But what was happening that winter was something else. People were dying. Not in a way the city could file away and forget. Not spread out across years, the way most violence is. These deaths were stacked close together, days apart, sometimes hours. And they were happening within walking distance of one another, in a narrow strip of neighborhood, just north of downtown. A 34-year-old man shot in the open. A 30-year-old killed for the $3 in his pocket. A young man gunned down in the street. And then, on a single cold February day, an elderly woman and her grown son murdered inside a home that was set on fire around their bodies. Five lives, one small map, a few short months. The people who lived there had a word for the young man at the center of it. They called him the neighborhood bully. They said his name carefully, if they said it at all. His name was Joshua Julius Anderson. He was 19 years old. And before the winter was over, investigators would link him to one out of every three murders committed in the entire city of Tulsa that year. This is the story of how that happened and how it finally stopped. Welcome to Among Monsters. I'm Maya Hansen. Today we're walking through the case of Joshua Julius Anderson, a convicted killer responsible for a string of murders in Tulsa, Oklahoma, between November of 2006 and February of 2007. The facts here are documented. They come from court records, police testimony, and contemporary news reporting from the Tulsa World and other outlets. Anderson was charged with four counts of first-degree murder, plus arson and assault with a dangerous weapon. He was arrested on February 2, 2007. He confessed days later, and in 2008, he was sentenced to four consecutive life terms without parole, plus an additional 35 years. But the facts of this case are also in places almost impossible to sit with. The final crime in particular is among the most disturbing in Oklahoma's modern criminal history. I'm going to tell you what happened plainly, because the victims deserve the truth. I'm not going to dwell where dwelling would only be cruel. This is the story of the victims, the investigation, the arrest, and the fear that settled over one Tulsa neighborhood and the day it finally lifted. Joshua Julius Anderson was born on June 17, 1987 in Oklahoma. Very little has been publicly documented about his early life. The details are thin, the kind of childhood that leaves almost no record until the trouble starts. And the trouble started early. When he was 15 years old, police in Muskogee accused him of shooting at someone with the intent to kill. The warrant was recalled less than a month later, and the matter went away. No conviction, no clear resolution, just a teenager already connected to gunfire. In June of 2005, when he was 18, the charges grew heavier. He was accused of kidnapping, of concealing stolen property, and of domestic assault and battery. As part of the plea deal, he admitted to kidnapping and the assault. The stolen property charge was dropped. He served 90 days in jail. A month after that, he was charged again. Another shooting, another person hurt, and once more, the case collapsed. This time, because the witness testimony was considered too weak to hold. You can already see the pattern forming. Charges that appear, then dissolve. Witnesses who go quiet. Cases that fall apart before they reach a courtroom. In a neighborhood where people are afraid, that's how it works. Fear is a kind of armor. If people are too frightened to testify, the system simply runs out of evidence. By the time Joshua Anderson reached his late teens, he and his older brother, A.C. Anderson, shared a house in a part of North Tulsa known for poverty, for drugs, and for violence. And in that neighborhood, Joshua had a reputation. Neighbors described him as someone who intimidated the people around him, someone you didn't cross, someone whose temper could turn a small dispute into something dangerous. They feared his name long before the murders began. What no one understood yet was just how far that fear could go. You have to understand the place where it happened. North Tulsa, in those years, was a community under strain. It had history, pride, families who had lived there for generations. But it also carried the weight of long neglect. Jobs were scarce, drugs moved openly, and violent crime had become a constant, low background hum. When violence is everywhere, something strange happens to how it is measured. A single murder in a quiet suburb becomes a headline that runs for weeks. The same murder in a neighborhood already drowning in crime can vanish into the paperwork. Another file, another case number, another grieving family that the wider city never hears about. That's part of what allowed Joshua Anderson to keep killing. His crimes didn't announce themselves as the work of one man. They looked, at first, like the ordinary tragedy of a hard place. A shooting here, a robbery there, each one terrible, none of them obviously connected. And Anderson moved through that landscape like he had owned it. Witnesses said he ruled his stretch of the street through fear. He was, in the plainest language that neighbors could find, a bully. Not a distant, shadowy figure. A young man they saw in daylight. A young man some of them knew by name and by face. That detail matters more than it might seem. Because in this case, recognizing Joshua Anderson's face would turn out to be the most dangerous thing a person could do. For now, though, the neighborhood simply endured him. People kept their heads down. They minded their business. They told themselves that if they stayed out of his way, they'd be fine. And here's the thing about that kind of survival logic. It works right up until the moment it doesn't. It depends on the predator following rules, on there being some line he won't cross, some category of person he'll leave alone. The elderly, the unarmed, the ones who never wronged him. Joshua Anderson, it would turn out, recognized no such line. The killings that were coming wouldn't be confined to rival dealers or men who came at him with weapons. They would reach a 69-year-old woman in her own home. There was no safe distance from him, no posture of submission that guaranteed protection. The neighborhood just didn't know that yet. Most of them stayed out of his way and were fine. Some of them weren't. The first murder linked to Joshua Anderson happened on November 5th, 2006. The victim was Vestario Tovias Jr. He was 34 years old. According to court testimony, Tovias came into the neighborhood that day looking for drugs. He was carrying a knife. What exactly set it off is unclear, but a fight broke out, not with Joshua at first, but with his older brother, AC. The two of them went after Tovias. They beat him, and then Joshua escalated it into something that could never be taken back. He produced a double-barreled shotgun. He fired once. A single shot struck Tovias twice, and it killed him. What Anderson did next tells you something about who he was. He looked down at the dead man, and he saw the knife. He took it, not as evidence, not to hide anything. He took it by his own later account, simply because he liked the way it looked. Then he walked away from the body, shotgun still in his hands, and disappeared back into the neighborhood. For the Tulsa police, this looked like one more homicide in a city full of them, a confrontation, a drug connection, a shooting, the kind of case that, in a place like North Tulsa, was painfully familiar. There was no reason yet to think it was the beginning of anything. A man had come looking for drugs, a fight had broken out, and a shotgun had ended it. In a city absorbing dozens of homicides a year, that story barely raised an eyebrow. It read as cause and effect, closed in the mind, if not on paper. But a man was dead. A family had lost a son, a brother. Vestario Tovias was a person with a life that mattered, reduced in an instant to a case file. And here is the part that should unsettle you. The thing that made this killing forgettable to the wider world was exactly the thing that made it safe for Joshua Anderson. He had learned by now that violence in this neighborhood didn't echo the way it would somewhere else. It got absorbed. It got filed. A killer paying attention could take a grim lesson from that. And Anderson was paying attention. The file went into a drawer with all the others. Months would pass before anyone connected it to what came next. As 2006 turned into 2007, the homicides in Tulsa kept coming. For the detectives working those cases, the math was brutal. Every killing demanded time. Crime scenes had to be processed. Witnesses had to be found and then convinced to talk. Evidence had to be gathered and tested. And there were only so many hours, so many investigators, so many resources to go around. So while detectives bent over one case, another one would land. This is the quiet truth about how serial offenders sometimes slip through. It isn't always that they're brilliant. Sometimes it's simply that the people hunting them are stretched too thin to see the shape of what's in front of them. And Joshua Anderson was particularly hard to see. Investigators look for patterns. A serial offender who targets a specific kind of victim, a constant method, a clear, repeated motive. Those threads are what let detectives connect one crime to another and say, this is the same hand at work. Anderson offered almost none of that. His victims didn't share a profile. They were different ages, different races, different backgrounds. A man here and an older woman there. Some connected to drugs, some not. There was no single type. No obvious signature that would make the detective stop and say, wait, these belong together. What connected his crimes wasn't a pattern in the usual sense. It was something simpler and colder. Most of them had seen his face. That was the thread. Robbery or a grudge or a dispute would put him in front of someone. And if that someone could later point at Joshua Anderson and name him, that person became a problem he intended to erase. But the police didn't know that yet. And in late January of 2007, the killing accelerated. On January 23, 2007, a 23-year-old man named Christopher Modrow crossed paths with the Anderson brothers. Modrow, by the accounts given in court, was looking for drugs. Joshua and AC walked with him toward a dealer. It should have been an ordinary, forgettable errand in a neighborhood where such things happened every day. Instead, an argument broke out. The details of what was said are lost, but the situation curled fast. At some point, Modrow pulled out an ice pick, maybe to defend himself, maybe to threaten. It didn't matter. Joshua Anderson drew a .22 caliber revolver and shot Christopher Modrow dead. Then he went through the dead man's pockets. He found $3. $3. That was the haul. That was what a human life was worth that day, in that place. To Joshua Anderson. He took it, climbed into his brother's car, and drove away from another body. $3. It's a number that refuses to make sense. And maybe that's the point. We want murder to have a reason large enough to match the weight of it. We want a motive that, even if it's monstrous, at least explains the scale of the loss. There was no reason here large enough. There almost never is. A man was killed for the price of nothing. And his family was left to carry a grief that had no proportion to the cause. Christopher Modrow's death landed on detectives' desks as another homicide in a violent winter. And the very next day, Joshua Anderson killed again. January 24, 2007, one day after Christopher Modrow. This time, the victim was 26-year-old David Gilbert. Earlier that day, according to witnesses, Anderson and Gilbert had gotten into it at a store, an altercation, the kind of small hot conflict that flares up and usually burns out. It didn't burn out. Witnesses said Joshua Anderson found David Gilbert and shot him to death, not over money this time, over the argument, over the disrespect, real or imagined, revenge, plain and simple. A young man was killed because he had words with the wrong person in the wrong neighborhood. Of all the killings linked to Joshua Anderson, David Gilbert's is the one that sits in a kind of legal shadow because Anderson was never actually charged with it. The evidence, in the end, was judged insufficient to bring to trial. That's a hard thing to hold. Witnesses pointed to him. The killing fit everything else investigators came to understand about him. But fitting a pattern is not the same as proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And the system, rightly, demands proof. So David Gilbert became part of the story without ever becoming part of the verdict. The fifth name, the one the courts could never formally close. His killing is why you'll sometimes hear that Anderson murdered four people, and sometimes hear five. Four were proven in court. The fifth, David Gilbert, was witnessed but never charged. Either way, by the end of that January, three men were dead within blocks of one another. And somewhere in the Tulsa homicide unit, a quieter question was beginning to form. It's one thing to absorb a steady stream of unrelated killings in a high crime area. It's another thing when the scenes start sitting on top of each other on the map. Tobias in November, Modrow in late January, Gilbert the very next day. All of them clustered inside a stretch of North Tulsa barely a mile across. There were technical breadcrumbs too. Ballistics work tied a .22 caliber weapon to the Modrow shooting. The robberies looked optimistic, hurried. The work of someone grabbing whatever was in the victim's pockets. And on the streets, among the informants police relied on in that part of the city, one name kept surfacing in connection with the violence. None of it was proof. The sheer volume of gun crime in the area was its own kind of camouflage, and it would take more than a hunch to draw firm lines between separate cases. But the outline was there. The neighborhood was holding its breath, and it had every reason to. What happened on February 2nd, 2007, is the reason this case is remembered. I'm going to tell it to you directly, and then I'm going to move on. The victims here were brutalized in ways that don't need to be turned into entertainment, but you should know what was done to them, because they deserve to be more than a footnote. It started with information. A.C. Anderson told his younger brother that a man named Herbert Hobbs had money on him. Herbert was 51 years old. He lived at a home on North Quaker Avenue. And on that day, his elderly mother, 69-year-old Rose Mary Hobbs, was there with him. Joshua Anderson went to the house armed with a revolver. His intention, as he later described it, was robbery. He tied them up, a grown man and his elderly mother bound in their own home. He took their money, by most accounts, about $300. And then, instead of leaving, he stayed. What he did next was an act of cruelty so degrading that it stunned even a veteran investigator who later worked the case. Prosecutors would describe it at trial as a deliberate humiliation of two helpless people who had done nothing to him. Then he shot them both, Herbert and Rosemary, each shot in the head. Rosemary was shot multiple times. And before he left, he set the house on fire with their bodies inside, hoping the flames would erase what he'd done. There is one more detail that surfaced at trial, one I'll state once and not return to. Prosecutors alleged that Anderson had consumed part of Rosemary Hobbs' remains. It became understandably the detail the public would never forget. But I want to be careful not to let the most lurid moments swallow the people themselves. Because Rosemary Hobbs was somebody's mother. Herbert Hobbs was somebody's son. They were a family, together in a home, on an ordinary winter day. And they were murdered for $300. And the simple fact that they had seen the face of the man who robbed them. The fire was meant to be the end of the trial. Instead, it was the beginning of his. The Hobbs home burned on February 2nd. It was a Friday. The bodies of Rosemary and Herbert Hobbs were found inside in a fire that investigators quickly concluded had been set deliberately. And on that very same day, Joshua Anderson was taken into custody. The arrest didn't come from the murders, at least not at first. Anderson was picked up in connection with a separate allegation entirely, a rape accusation that had nothing on its face to do with the killings. But once detectives had him, the larger picture began to come into focus, and it came into focus fast. By that point, investigators were no longer looking at isolated tragedies. Bodies had been turning up within a single one-mile radius since the previous November. Different victims, different days, but the same small map. Tobias, Modrow, Gilbert, and now two more. Burned in a home on North Quaker. Five people gone inside a few hundred yards of one another, and the brothers Anderson living right in the middle of it. When detectives ran the numbers against the rest of the city, the results stopped them cold. These killings, concentrated in this one tiny pocket of Tulsa, accounted for roughly a third of every homicide in the entire city for that period. One small neighborhood, one reoccurring name. Over the days that followed the weekend arrest, the complaints began to stack up. What had started as a single unrelated accusation grew into a list of first-degree murder charges, each one a name, each one a scene that detectives were now connecting to the young man already sitting in their custody. The key that unlocked the case wasn't forensics. It was family. A.C. Anderson, Joshua's older brother, was brought in for questioning. And in that interview room, A.C. began to talk. He pointed at his younger brother. He told detectives that Joshua was involved in the killings. It's worth pausing on the strangeness of that. Through all of it, the fear, the silence, the witnesses who wouldn't speak, the thing that family cracked the case open came from inside Joshua Anderson's own household. The one person close enough to know, choosing to tell. Detectives now had something they could use. They had a name spoken by someone with intimate knowledge. They had a cluster of killings in a single small area. They had a young man already in custody. What they needed now was for Joshua Anderson himself to talk. And getting there would take one carefully chosen moment in an interrogation room. On February 5th, 2007, Tulsa detective Vic Ringolato sat down across from Joshua Anderson. He started with the Hobbs murders, the double homicide on North Quaker. Anderson gave him nothing. According to Rigaldo's later testimony, Anderson absolutely denied knowing what the detective was even talking about. He played it cold, blank, as if the question itself were absurd, so the detective changed his approach. He didn't argue. He didn't push harder. He simply showed Joshua Anderson a piece of videotape. On that tape was A.C. Anderson, his own brother, telling police that Joshua had done the killings. The effect, Rigaldo said, was immediate. Anderson became visibly agitated, visibly upset. The cold mask cracked. And what broke through wasn't guilt, exactly. It was betrayal. He couldn't believe, he said, that his own brother would tell on him. And then he made a choice that sealed his fate. If I'm going to go down, he said, everybody is going down. He started to talk. Over the course of that interview, Joshua Anderson described his involvement in the killings, four homicides across three different locations in Tulsa. He laid out details, methods, things that lined up with what investigators had found at the scenes, things that hadn't been made public. That corroboration mattered. It meant his confession wasn't just echoing his brother's words. He knew things only the killer could know. When he spoke about the Hobbs murders, he gave the detectives his motive in killing. Simple terms. He killed them, he indicated, because they had seen his face. At one point, by Rigaldo's account, Anderson said he was already dead, that he was ready for the penitentiary. It was the voice of someone who had stopped expecting any other future. Those words spoken in that room would become the spine of the case against him. They would also become the thing his defense fought hardest to take away. Because a confession, once given, is not automatically allowed to stand. It has to survive scrutiny first. And that fight was coming. Before any jury was ever seated, there was a preliminary hearing. This is the stage where the court decides whether the state even has enough to proceed, whether the evidence is sufficient to send a defendant to trial at all. For Joshua Anderson, that hearing brought a detective named Vic Rigaldo to the stand to lay out what Anderson had said in the interrogation room. Anderson's chief public defender pushed back hard. He filed a motion to suppress an attempt to keep his client's statements out of the case entirely, to argue that the confession should never reach a jury's ears. Tulsa County Special Judge Cliff Smith denied that motion. The confession would stand, and with it admitted, Smith ordered Joshua Anderson held for trial on four counts of first-degree murder plus arson and assault with a dangerous weapon. It was at the same hearing that the chilling fragments of Anderson's own attitude entered the record. He had told detectives, by Rigaldo's account, that he was already dead, that he was ready for the penitentiary. A defendant, in effect, concealing his own future before the trial had even begun. The actual reckoning came in stages across the autumn of 2008. The first and most serious trial centered on the Hobbs murders. It began on October 22, 2008 in Tulsa County District Court before Judge Tom Gillert. Anderson faced two counts of first-degree murder for Hubert and Rosemary Hobbs, plus a count of first-degree arson for the fire. His defense argued the way defense attorneys must. His public defender pointed out what the state didn't have. No fingerprints tying him to the scene. No physical arson evidence laying the fire at his feet. The defense asked the jury to see the gaps, to hold the prosecution to the higher bar the law demands. But the jury had heard the confession. They had watched and listened to Anderson, in his own recorded words, acknowledge what he'd done. They had heard the testimony that pieced the night together. After 2 days of trial and roughly 2 hours of deliberation, the jury returned its verdict. Guilty. Guilty on both counts of murder. Guilty of arson. For the murders of Hubert and Rosemary Hobbs, the jury recommended 2 life sentences without the possibility of parole. For the arson, an additional term of years. That was the first reckoning. The second came weeks later. On December 8, 2008, Joshua Anderson stood again, this time for the killings of Vastaro Tavias and Christopher Modro. He did not fight those charges. He pleaded guilty to both murders, accepting 2 more life terms, along with additional time for the assault charge tied to the violence. When the math was finished, it came to this. 4 counts of first-degree murder, 4 consecutive life sentences without parole, plus 35 years on top for the arson and the assault. Joshua Julius Anderson, by then 21 years old, would spend the rest of his life in an Oklahoma prison with no road back out. There's one more thread to this case, and it's the one that left some of the victims' families uneasy. Given the sheer brutality, given 5 linked killings, and the horror inside the Hobbs home, many people assumed prosecutors would pursue the death penalty. They didn't. The reason was a legal determination that Joshua Anderson was intellectually disabled. In the language of that era's court, he was found to be, in the legal sense, mentally retarded. That finding carried enormous weight because of the United States Supreme Court decision. In the 2002 case of Atkins versus Virginia, the court ruled that executing a person with intellectual disability violates the Constitution's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. It is, under American law, simply not permitted. So for once, that determination was made about Anderson. The death penalty was off the table, not as mercy, as constitutional requirement. For some, that was an unbearable outcome. They looked at what was done to the Hobbs family, to Tavias, to Modro, and they could not reconcile it with any limit on punishment. For others, it was the law working exactly as it should. Even when the defendant is monstrous, especially then, the protection isn't there because the worst offenders deserve our sympathy. It's there because a society that wants to call its justice fair has to apply its rules even to the people it would most like to make an exception for. Both of those reactions are human. Both are honest. The law made its choice, and Joshua Anderson lives. But living in his case means something very specific. 4 consecutive life sentences without parole is not a number designed to ever be served out. It's a wall. It means there is no parole board in his future, no calendar counting down to a release date, no scenario short of a successful appeal that returns him to the street. He went into Oklahoma prison system as a young man in his 20s, and the sentence is built so that the only way he leaves is in a box. For the families, that knowledge is a complicated comfort. It is not the death penalty some of them wanted, but it is permanence. It means they will not spend the rest of their lives bracing for a parole hearing, rehearsing their grief in front of a board, fighting again and again to keep him where he is. He remains in the custody of the Oklahoma Department of Corrections, serving those 4 consecutive life terms with no possibility of parole. He will not be released. When it was over, People did the arithmetic, and the number was staggering. By the time of his arrest, Joshua Anderson was connected to roughly one out of every three homicides in the entire city of Tulsa for that year. One young man, one small neighborhood, a third of the city's killings. And then, just as suddenly as it began, it stopped. The body stopped appearing on North Quaker and the streets around it. The neighborhood that had spent a winter holding its breath was finally able to exhale. But exhaling is not the same as healing. Five people were taken: Tavias Jr., Christopher Modrow, David Gilbert, Hubert Hobbs, and Rosemary Hobbs. Men and women, young and old, who had families, routines, ordinary mornings they expected to keep having, each of them reduced in moments to a name in a case file and a wound that their loved ones still carry. Say their names slowly, because the man who killed them counted on us not to. He chose victims in a place the wider city had already learned to overlook. He counted on the noise of an overburdened neighborhood to swallow the sound of what he did. For a while, it nearly worked. It would be easy to make this story only about the monster at its center, about the bully, the confession, the unthinkable scene in the Hobbs home. He is, after all, why these names are gathered here. But the deeper truth of a case like this is quieter and harder. It's about how violence concentrates in the places we've decided to look away from. How fear can keep a whole neighborhood silent while one person turns it into a hunting ground. How the thread that finally caught him wasn't justice arriving from outside, but a brother in an interrogation room choosing to speak. Joshua Anderson will die in prison. The law made sure of that. What it could not do was give back the five lives that bought his. I'm Maya Hansen, and this has been Among Monsters.